Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Boiled Leather Audio Hour. My name is Sean T. Collins. I cover Game of Thrones for Rolling Stone. I am the founder of All There Must Be Boiled at BoiledLeather.com, which is the blog where this lovely podcast is hosted. And I'm extremely happy to be back with my esteemed co-host.
I'm Stefan Sasse. I'm a contributor to the Tower of the Hand, and I have my own blog for all things nerd at thenerdstreamera.blogspot.com. And I am in turn happy on the one hand to welcome back Sean T. Collins and finally get another episode rolling. And on the other hand, yeah, it's great. And on the other hand, to introduce a special guest who has been on the podcast before, but we're always happy to have him.
Hi, everyone. My name is Amin. I'm from a podcast of Ice and Fire, and it's great to be back on Boiled Leather.
I always love when our two little gangs get together. It's Voltron, I think. I get to be the head lion, though. I have to insist. I don't want to be like the left foot or something.
We like it, the podcast transformer.
I think this will be an interesting episode because it's going to be, I think, fairly wide ranging. But to start out, we would like to talk about something that Stefan wrote for the sort of director's cut expanded edition of the essay collection. What's the name of the essay collection? Why can't I remember now? Flight of Sorrows, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Sort of assembled by various Tower of the Hand contributors, and it's being re-released in an expanded edition. And Stefan has an essay in it that kind of connects a whole bunch of separate plot lines with one particular theme, and Stefan, I'll kick it over to you to tell us what you were talking about in the essay.
Yeah, I have to warn everyone, of course, because it will be a little bit like an advertisement. So I get that out of the way in the beginning, so we can concentrate on the essay later on. Because if you haven't heard yet, there is this collector's edition of our Flight of Sorrows in a printed edition that you can really hold in your hands, and it is only available in October. So get your hands on it before it vanishes forever from the realms of the purchasable content. So, what am I talking about? I made this essay about one topic, and this topic is revenge, because I don't exactly remember how I got to think about it, but when I did, I recognized that revenge is important in several storylines in the book, and a pervasive theme for me seems to be that this revenge that is intended by so many of these characters is never going to end well. I looked at Wyman Manderly, I looked at the Martells, obviously, I made a quick look at the Targaryens, and of course for Arya, and none of them is on any path that, if you draw it out into the future, leads to anything like a happy end. And so my conclusion was that revenge isn't something you should root for in the whole story of Ice and Fire. And if you ever read the Doran chapters again, don't be so quick to root for Doran's plan to succeed, because yes, it goes against the Lannisters, but it will also drown a whole continent in blood. And this blood, as usual, is spent by innocents. And so that's the essence of my essay.
I think one of the interesting and provocative things about the essay, making the argument that vengeance in these books as a driver of character behavior, and particularly political and military behavior, is sort of nearly always a bad thing in the end, is that this is really an aspect of Martin's genre revisionism, I think, because usually the narrative economy or the moral economy in stories like this, the way it works is that you root for the good guys to get revenge against the bad guys. That's kind of usually how the story works, you know. The bad guys wrong the good guys in some way, and the story ends when the good guys come back and are able to kill the bad guys, and the bad guys get their comeuppance. I mean, any 80s action movie you care to name basically has that story. And I was thinking that this is a very, you know, the insistence on showing us the consequences of these vengeance plots and of showing that the behavior of the good guys and the bad guys, if you will, is sort of has the same motivator in a lot of cases. You know, is there really anything all that different between what Arya would like to do to the Lannisters and what the Lannisters did to the Reigns of Castamere? Not really. I think this is one of the more challenging elements of the story in terms of the story's position in the genre of epic fantasy.
Yeah, definitely. I started out looking at the Dornish in particular because revenge is so prominently displayed in their storyline. But the more I thought about the subject, the more I realized that it's in there and the other storylines as well. And it wasn't something that had sprung to my mind before. It just came when I looked at the Dorne storyline. And I think it's fairly hidden as a theme.
Yeah, I liked how you pointed out Wyman Manderly, which like most people enjoy reading his kind of revenge, but he is guilty as other people for potentially going down that no ending route, right?
Yeah, absolutely, and it is absolutely outrageous. It is really ugly what he does. I mean, he cooks his enemies and eats them. That's normally a behavior that's reserved in the antique sagas of old. It is reserved for those guys that are then punished by the gods and stuff like that. But here it is kind of presented like something to root for, and at the same time, it's so... you know what I mean? Just to think about it, it's the quote-unquote good guy here, I don't see this end that well, because that's what I asked myself. What is the objective of Wyman Manderly's revenge? Will he kill all the Freys? Will he kill all the Boltons? What will he do exactly?
Yeah, I don't know where it ends. And the presentation of it in the books, you know, once you figure out that that's what happened, it is delightful, in all honesty. You know, I mean, I think all the fandom, when they caught into what was going on, kind of flipped out, and Wyman Manderly is this big folk hero, and the show incorporated the phrase "the North remembers" into, I think it was the title of the first episode of the second season. You know, so gung-ho about that sort of message that it worked it into the story way before it actually shows up in the novels. And it's funny, and there's all sorts of fan art for it. And I remember having a similar reaction when Jon Snow beheaded Janos Slynt, which it was obviously within his rights, as you know, as those rights were constructed in that time period and in that world. It was, you know, I don't support capital punishment at all in real life, but I was cheering. You know, I was like, yeah, cut his fucking head off. I hate that guy. You know, and Jon's case. You do get the sense that if Slynt had played ball, John would not have sought vengeance against him, because that's just the kind of person John is.
But exactly.
Once he does have that excuse, you, the reader, want your vengeance for Ned, and you get it, and it's awesome.
But yeah, it's a bit of a guilty pleasure.
Exactly, it's a guilty pleasure, and I think in the case of Dorne, because of our frustration with Doran Martell, and because of the way we see those plots kind of working out and not working out, as the case may be, it becomes easier to see, like, as much as you sympathize with Doran for what happened to his family, given the brutality of what happened and how they were innocent and how loathsome Gregor Clegane and Amory Lorch are, not to mention Tywin himself, your natural inclination is to root for him. But you do start to see what a bloodbath it would be, and you also start to see that there are limits in terms of any mastermind's ability to affect and to make good on his promises of revenge. You know, he tried as much, you know, he tried to, as best he could, but, you know, a marriage pact is barely worth the paper it's printed on. His son dies. You know, the arrival of Aegon complicates things. So it starts to be like, how long does he pursue this in the face of all these logistical obstacles? I don't know. And I just kind of get the sense that it's not going to be all that great for that society if it continues past the point where it can be achieved quickly and with the sort of focus, because so many of the key figures are dead now.
Yeah, it is also a very interesting build in the narrative, because you start with all these crazy revenge plans by the Sand Snakes, who want to drown everyone in blood for just because they can, and they are imprisoned by Doran, and he seems like the voice of reason. You know, you don't do this kind of stuff. You have to have rational goals and all of that, and he lulls you, like he lulls everyone, into this false confidence that Doran Martell is a rational player of the Game of Thrones. But he isn't. In Arryn's chapter, and especially later on in Dance with Dragons, we really learn that he has the exact same objective as the Sand Snakes. He's just a little bit more clever about it, but there is nothing rational behind this. He really wants to do the same, just in a bit more clever way. And that, for me, was one of the great revelations, especially of the Dance with Dragons rereads.
Yeah, I have quite a few things to talk to you about Dorne, what I thought. But first, I wanted to mention, as you mentioned early in the article, and why sometimes we do feel like happy to see bad people getting what's coming to them, is there's no independent legal system or independent arbiter to turn to when things happen, and people have to do it themselves. And when you do it yourself, it's human instinct to go beyond justice and try to get revenge. That's the problem, right? There's no system they can turn to. People are doing it by themselves, trying to get justice themselves, but it just goes too far.
Yeah, that's right.
At the start, you have a lot of examples of revenge. There's lots of them in there. But I wanted to ask you specifically about when Robb Stark had to kill Carr Stark, and you put that in there. But I want to see, like, how would that... Why do you say that's under revenge? Because I think that's one of the closest things to kind of justice. I mean, he didn't want to do it, but he kind of had to do it because prisoners were murdered in their cells, like young boys were murdered in their cells. What else should he have done other than send him to the wall?
Did I include that in the revenges?
Well, you didn't say revenge. You said avenges. And I think you might have put there, because Robb Stark does talk about how his honor was killed by what Carr Stark did, but what he did was kind of what was required.
Yeah. Robb was definitely acting as the legal overlord, and what he did was technically his duty. So I wouldn't say that he really... Of course, he also took a little bit revenge. He could easily have sent him to the wall, but he wanted to make a statement here. But it's a little bit like John, not so clear-cut, but still on a different level than what Manderly and the Martells and, of course, Lady Stoneheart are doing.
Kind of gets back to the point about how there's no independent system to adjudicate these things. And it's true, a lord works as... has an executive position and has a judicial position. And in the case of certain lords, is the executioner themselves, judge, jury, executioner. They're setting the laws in a lot of, in terms of making ad hoc decisions about cases brought before them, even though there seems to be some sort of generally agreed upon legal code as to who owes what to whom. Although, of course, we've seen all the conflicts that can arise when two different bonds of loyalty are placed in opposition.
So you're basically saying that Eddard Stark is Judge Dredd?
Yes, I am saying that Eddard Stark is Judge Dredd.
Okay, good that we cleared that.
One thing I was thinking in terms of a vengeance plot that we see sort of come to fruition, and then we can track its results and its unforeseen consequences, is that of the Tyrells against Stannis Baratheon. Okay. Loras Tyrell successfully avenges Renly in the sense that he stops Stannis from taking over King's Landing with the help of his family. But then that winds up embroiling him in this alliance of convenience with the Lannisters, who are a bunch of nightmares for them, and people get murdered, and and he winds up in his continued pursuit of vengeance, getting boiling oil poured on him. And so that, I think, is a very clear-cut example of... In terms of, as a governing policy, vengeance leaves a lot to be desired, because you wind up taking steps that you can't walk back.
Yeah, but yeah. I would say for the Tyrell example, they were also going for power, right? I mean, maybe Loras was driven by revenge. And related to Dorne, I was reading your essay, it made me rethink. I was thinking, what does Dorne want? Dorne itself and Doran. Dorne itself just wanted vengeance. You can see, like, the Sand Snakes wanted to do stuff. Does Doran just want to get vengeance, or does he want to get Dorne back in the sense of power? And would that improve things for you, Stefan, or you wouldn't still improve? Like, what motivation would win you over for Doran? Like, just that if he had stopped with killing the murderers and he just went for isolationist Dorne or something?
Yeah, the power, I have the feeling that getting Dorne into a powerful position is just means to an end, because the original plan, if you want to kill everyone that can be remotely held responsible for it, as Dorne Martell is doing, that means all the Lannisters, basically as a family and as a power factor in Westeros, you have to have a strong Dorne. It's not doable without. But I don't think that his ultimate goal is to make Dorne into the most powerful kingdom, or to get a Dornish queen back on the throne or anything like that. It doesn't seem to me that he has such mundane goals. For me, Doran seems more motivated by this personal thing. He wants the realm, as it has materialized itself by Robert's Rebellion, to be winded back into the Targaryen state.
You're saying that he was restraining people just because he was planning for a later strike rather than being reasonable? Like, for example, like with the way he treats with Myrcella, it seems to me, unless he's hiding his feelings, he's not going to kill Myrcella. I mean, in one sense, it didn't make sense to kill her just because he wanted to wait, but it doesn't seem like he's a type that he would kill Myrcella later on. It seems to me that he understands that Myrcella is innocent.
Yeah, that might be, yes. Now that you mention, I don't have a feeling that he would order specifically her death as a hostage, but if she would stand in the way, or if she just would be killed, I guess he would take a Tywin attitude to it. I just forgot to mention to spare Myrcella, you know what I mean? I don't know.
I think he's mixed. I definitely think the vengeance part is there because he says it himself, vengeance, fire, and blood, and he's asking for it. But I think there's like the problem is because he himself is doing it instead of appealing to some sort of council or something. He's mixing revenge with other motives, and it's all tangled together. Because in some ways, like the spread of the Dornish court isn't necessarily bad. If you look at Dornish culture, and that's what I talk about in my essay in Flight of Sorrows and Analyze the Culture. I mean, if you're a woman, wouldn't you want to live in Dorne? And if you were in Westeros, right? Like, odds are you'd want to live there. So the spread of Dornish law would be better for the women of the whole Westeros.
Most likely, yes. But if the Dornish, they are, as anything in Martin's world, there are gray, you know, there are good things about Dornish culture, like the better position for women. And it seems to me the people are generally a little bit more free and not exactly better off materially, but in regards to what they can do and what they can become. But on the other hand, you have this highly aggressive, oftentimes ethnically pumped up atmosphere that is prone to doing stupid and cruel things. I'm really interested in seeing the Hellhold, by the way, because they have often been mentioned as especially mad, even for Dornish, and it seems to say something. So I would be very interested in seeing them.
Dorne is where Darkstar came from, so when you have somebody like Darkstar.
Yeah, he's a special kind of nuts. And I want to go out and say there is nothing, but all these fan theories that Darkstar is in some way Azor Ahai or something else important. No, he isn't. He's a stupid fuck ass who gets what he deserves, I hope.
Fuck ass.
Yeah, sorry, we're not aiming for PG-13, obviously.
Let's say, you know, my attitude with these things is always the books are far filthier than anything that we say. So I have no problem cussing like a sailor, and I don't think anyone else should either. Well, are there cases that where we've seen in the books an act of vengeance that you feel is wholly appropriate and not excessive and doesn't lead to trouble? I'm trying to think.
Yeah, I didn't really find one. I mean, explicit revenge. I discount things like Robb Stark's execution of Karr Stark and Jon cutting the head of Janis Lind, because while it may also somehow give them a little bit of satisfaction for revenge, it is not the main motivator, because we exactly know that these people brought it on themselves. If they had stayed quiet, nothing would have happened. And that is not true about the targets of other kind of vengeances we see. I mean, just look at Robert Baratheon. One of the first things we learn about him is that he wants to kill every Targaryen, even little Daenerys, who is a frightened 13-year-old.
That's true, and it's out of character for him, because we also learn that he's famously lenient with enemies who are willing to bend the knee. It's just that he has this grudge against the Targaryens that...
Yeah, he wants revenge, and it is not portrayed as anything good. So I don't think that there is an instance of a good revenge that happens just exactly as you want it to happen in the books. Not as yet.
Yeah, you know, I was going to suggest Arya's use of Jaqen against the various Lannister war criminals that he has him execute. But at the same time, because she's a child, she was focused on the immediate, you know, on the near term and the people who were right there in front of her. But if she had, you know, given it, if she had been old enough and sophisticated enough to say, okay, you know, Joffrey, Tywin, and a third, I don't know, Gregor Clegane, a third party to be named later, Tyrion, she could have ended the war, you know.
Yeah.
Which is not necessarily to say that Martin's saying, oh, vengeance is appropriate, but it has to be the right, you have to make sure you're getting vengeance against the right person.
Absolutely.
Just that even the things that seem basically reasonable and don't require a great deal of collateral damage against innocent civilians still don't really pan out the way that you'd want them to. And I think it's something to consider as we move forward and see, you know, a potentially much harder and more violent Daenerys Targaryen return from the Dothraki Sea.
Yeah, that will be very interesting to see. I frighten it.
Yeah.
You know, but Arya, to return to her, is a different kind of beast. And that's a point I make in my essay as well, because her revenge actions are strange because she oftentimes takes revenge on behalf of others. It starts with killing Chizik, who admitted to raping someone she doesn't even know, but she kills him for it. And she kills Daeron, who has done nothing to her. Really nothing at all, but she takes revenge on part of the Night's Watch, which really isn't exactly her business. And I am very frightened to think about what else she might think is in the good interest of society to kill people.
The people that she kills generally would get that punishment anyways, but the fact that she's doing it is kind of making her maybe devalue life in general. Like, because a lot of the choices that she kills, you're like, well, the guy needed killing. But the fact that she did it is what affected her, right? Because you can't, like, I mean, like, even Daeron, I mean, technically his sentence was death, right? He deserted the watch, but she didn't have to be the one to do it.
That's a good point.
I don't know why I never thought of that before, but you're absolutely right. You know, that is the proper sentence for someone who deserts the Night's Watch, and they make a big deal out of how you're literally safe nowhere, because anyone will kill you if they see that you're a deserter from the Night's Watch. It's not just that, oh, we better watch out. The Boltons are lenient, but the Starks aren't. But if I get so far south, they're like, no, you have nowhere to hide. If they know you're a deserter from the Night's Watch, they will kill you on sight. So, of course, yeah, you're right. Arya is within her rights and within her duty, apparently, as a Westerosi citizen, to the extent that there's citizenship.
I think she got criticized for that, too, though, because that showed that she hadn't given up her Stark side or her past that she did that. The guy's like, you shouldn't be doing it. It's not your business. You're nobody now.
Right. So. Yes, that's true. That's true.
There are two things about this murder. For the first one, something that I pointed out in the essay is that she cannot understand that the kindly man doesn't share her view of people who deserve to die. She still doesn't understand what House of Black and White is, and I doubt she ever will. And on the second hand, killing this Night's Watch deserter might be her Stark side and stuff like that, yada, yada. But she totally forgoes the part with, you have to look him in the eye and hear his last words. That kind of stuff is not really in her mind. So I would not really concur on this one.
Well, she even thinks about killing some person who was going to, like, I think she thinks that, like, when she was just trying to sell her horse, like, when she was still in Westeros, she's like, oh, thought about, like, just taking it or whatever, but I'd be caught. So she's definitely, like, she's slipping, like, her sense of right and wrong. Like, it's kind of weird, because I think she was thinking she was going to sell, like, a horse, and then she was getting cheated, but she's like, oh, we're not alone. Like, do you remember that?
Yeah, killing becomes the natural conclusion to every problem for her.
Yeah, well, Arya is very much a story of how repeated exposure to violence at such a young age sort of systematically dehumanizes her, and you know, it's grim. And you know, I'm really curious. I'm watching Game of Thrones with my mother.
Lately.
That's how I've been spending my time. She's never seen it before, and she's really enjoying it. And like a lot of viewers, she loves Arya, and you know, it's a fun character, and we're kind of primed as viewers to expect a certain thing out of tomboys. It's obviously a very, very, very strong performance from a child actor. At the same time, Arya will eventually get to a place where her behavior becomes disturbing and sad. It already is sad when you think about it, but because she's kind of a spunky character, it's easy to overlook. But I think perhaps you see that to an extent when she murders the phrase that she comes across after the Red Wedding on the show, there's catharsis for the viewer in that, because this is, it's basically the only vengeance against the perpetrators of the Red Wedding that you're afforded as a viewer at this point in time. But it's also very troubling to see a child uncontrollably stab people to death. And, you know, as she goes forward and literally begins the process of shedding her identity, although, as you point out, she doesn't shed it entirely, and that's probably going to be the source of some kind of conflict going forward. It's a very explicit examination of how violence and vengeance are inimical to humanity in some way.
Generally, Boiled Leather's point of view, the books are often about the plight of the small folk and like the Game of Thrones, but this is another universal theme that may be in there, just the how revenge doesn't pay off in the end.
Yeah.
It's a really good, really well outlined essay and definitely a must read.
Thank you. I'm already feeling fuzzy and warm inside.
Well, should we shift over to our next topic?
Yeah,
or do we think that we've... All right, let's do it. And it's really kind of... I don't know if it's shifting gears in a weird way, because I think we started to sort of touch on this as we kind of played out various threads and looking forward into the future, if these plots of violence continue or if they fall apart. But we just wanted to go over some what-ifs, some... Looking at sort of these linchpin moments in the history of Westeros and in the story as we've seen, and just kind of chatting about how things could have gone differently, what things would have looked like, what consequences there would have been, which I think is something that a lot of fans do. And certainly our sort of idle conversations offline often go in this direction. But I don't know, do either of you guys have one that you particularly want to look at first? Or?
I would give the choice to Amin.
Okay, well, one that just came to mind when I was reading the essay was because we were looking at how Brandon caused all that trouble, or just what type of person Brandon was. I'm just wondering, how do you think that how would have Brandon been as the Lord of Winterfell, one, and like two with Catelyn, and three, like how do you think he would have got along with Robert? Because it seems like almost like he would get along better with Robert than Ned would.
I would attack the last statement because I think it is a personal theory of mine that people who are too much alike don't really can become good friends, because they always act as a mirror to one another, and most people don't like to look in a mirror too closely.
Or two alphas can't be in the same area.
that's a real problem here, and I think that's why Eddard and Robert did become such good friends. So, but how would he have been as a lord? I think he would have been a very much Stark lord, more Stark than Eddard was, because Eddard has many, many influences from the Vale and from the Arryn kind of way, and Bran seems more like the old North, you know, this the wild thing, quick to anger, the North remembers, all that stuff. It would not have been such a beloved rule like Eddard's was.
Yeah, I think there's a degree to which Westeros wouldn't be big enough for both Brandon and Robert, you know, an ascendant Brandon and an ascendant Robert. I mean, there's the fact that it was, you know, Robert is more of an age with Ned. They were raised together like brothers by Jon Arryn. So there's that relationship to think of. I don't know how it would have worked with Brandon. I'd imagine it's possible Brandon would have meddled more with a relationship between Lyanna and Robert than Ned would have. There's all sorts of things to think about with those two guys. He's a Robert-esque figure, right? He's a bit of a coxman. He is hot-tempered.
How do you think he would have been with Catelyn? And did you think he would have like had some bastards of his own afterwards, or do you think he would have been faithful? Do you think?
It sounds like he almost certainly would have. I know that this is like an oddly controversial point of view to take about Brandon, that Brandon was a little bit of a cad. But I mean, being a cad is not the worst thing in the world compared to a lot of these guys. Like I don't even remember where I heard it, but there was I think it might have been on a podcast of Ice and Fire. There was an extremely passionate debate maybe it was on a guy's night out over whether people were being fair to Brandon. And it's like, well, no one's accusing him of ripping a baby out of a cradle and smashing its head against the wall. They're just saying he slept around a bit. You know, he was whatever, how old he was, you know, in his late teens, early 20s. And, you know, he's a lord, and they're kind of raised apparently to have a certain point of view about what's owed them and what they're entitled to as lords. And he has a wild side. It's not saying, you know, you're not saying he's a monster. You're just saying he's a bit of a, you know, he's a bit of a slut. And that's okay. Robert was too. It was only when Robert attempted to govern, and in Robert's conduct towards Cersei, who is an admittedly unpleasant person but didn't deserve to be hit or raped in her marital bed, that Robert's behavior starts becoming genuinely problematic and not just sort of distasteful, but it's no crime. I do wonder if the two of them were in charge, if their, let's say, spirited behavior would lead them into some sort of conflict down the line. I assume Ned would have been employed as a go-between, but there's really no way of knowing.
I guess when he would have been alive, Robert wouldn't have been that important because he wouldn't have become king. There wouldn't have been a rebellion.
That's a good point, unless you lend credence to the idea that there was a conspiracy brewing already.
Yeah.
How do you think I would harbor such a thought?
Well, I was referring to Sir Southron's ambitions. Brandon didn't necessarily have to die for the war to have started anyways. In fact, Brandon basically threw his life away by just charging in there trying to get revenge, and he more than Robert caused the war. Robert was mainly just defending himself at the first point. It was either fight or die.
Yeah,
and I get the sense that Aerys would have overstepped eventually anyway.
But I guess the normal course of events would have been that grand council that Rhaegar wanted to call. So less power for the crown, no Aerys anymore, but no war either.
That's true.
We're doing what-ifs here. They send Ned as a kindful ambassador instead of Brandon, but they still kill Ned, and then Brandon survives. That's what happened. So the whole war happened, except Brandon survives.
We still have a war, of course, because Brandon is not like the forgiving type.
Yeah.
At least what we heard of him. Yeah, that's it about Brandon, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know if it's similar at all. But it's another war-related question. Sure. And this is my big what-if that I started – just it occurred to me and I started really thinking it through and having a grand old time with it. What if Renly had – he flees King's Landing, but then he takes up his brother's cause. He does the legal thing and doesn't claim the throne for himself, but persuades the Tyrells to go along, and it's a total Baratheon-Tyrell – alliance mounts its assault against the Lannisters rather than, so that there's no Renly won't be assassinated and there's not the split between Renly's forces and all that kind of thing. The thing that I sort of focused on is that, it seemed that they obviously would have won for sure between Stannis's fleet and the combined ground forces of the Stormlands and the Reach. There's basically no question that they would have been able to take King's Landing. And it's not as though the Lannisters could reach out to Dorne, because Dorne hates the Lannisters. So there's no hope of a sort of rear guard action against the south of the Reach or the south of the Stormlands. They obviously couldn't have reached out to Robb or the north. I really don't know what they're... I guess they would have had to desperately try and persuade Balon Greyjoy to use his fleet in some way to harry the Reach or to directly attack Stannis. They really didn't have a lot of options. And so that leaves you with Stannis on the Iron Throne, which would not end well for a lot of King's Landing characters. I think that would be the end of Littlefinger. I think that would be the end of Varys.
I doubt Littlefinger.
I can't imagine Stannis has any patience for Littlefinger at all.
I think they would leave like rats, if he was coming there. They'd get out the hell out of it. They knew they wouldn't survive if they stayed there.
Nah, I think when you started, I thought about Littlefinger first, because the whale is his to command, basically, at least to keep out of the war. And I guess he would have kept it out of the war because there was no chance to get Lysa Arryn in. But I think his chances are not that bad, because he is very good friends with Renly. That could be his lifesaver. Varys, not so much.
Yeah.
But Littlefinger has a chance with Renly.
Okay, here's a question. Yeah. Didn't Stannis say that he would make Renly, he would give Storm's End to Renly, but did he say he'd even put him as his heir until he had a son?
Yes.
Because, odds are that he's not going to have a son, right? So odds are that Renly is going to succeed. If you wanted to be a betting person, Renly would still be able to get the Tyrells and marry. Because first of all, he'll be the Lord of Storm's End and second in line to the throne. But odds are that Stannis is not going to have another heir. So.
Yeah.
That's true. And he might have, he does that as sort of through gritted teeth as an attempt to persuade Renly to join his side. But I think there's reason to believe that he might have just done that. If Renly had signed up with him to begin with, he might have done that to be nice.
Yeah.
You know, because he does like to reward good conduct. So
correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't Renly his heir anyway, if he has no son?
That's the tricky part, right? Like, if it was for Storm's End, wouldn't it be Shireen? But if it's for the kingdom, it might not be.
I don't know.
Yeah, this is not my area of expertise at all. Yeah. I think the most alarming thing about this what-if scenario for me is Melisandre at the heart of power in Westeros. I think that would have gotten very ugly very fast.
If she even gets to Stannis, I think it depends on how fast this Renly-Stannis alliance is made.
Wasn't she in there already? Well, when did she arrive? Do we know?
We don't know. That's one of the big unknowns. Still, we don't have a clue how Melisandre came to Dragonstone. We don't know how she got to Stannis. We don't know anything about it. Not even now, five books in.
Had Stannis left his wife on Dragonstone when he was in King's Landing?
For sure.
Because if he had, then I presume that Melisandre was there at Dragonstone when Stannis got back and was like, oh, and his wife's like, oh, meet this lady. I've converted to her religion and, you know, so have all my retainers. And Stannis is like, oh, that's great, honey.
yeah, that's exactly Stannis. Right.
Did he get rid of those fetus jars yet, or are they still?
I thought they were a great idea by the show, by the way.
That was fun. I'd imagine that even if the war were to end quicker, because I also assume that, well, here's a question for you. Would Stannis force Rob to take the knee and relinquish his crown?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, he would.
Well, even Renly wanted some sort of control over Rob. Like, Stannis for sure would want it. I think that one of the problems in the whole Stannis thing is the problem Stannis has bad blood with the Reach. I mean, almost to the point of revenge, although Stannis technically shouldn't be the kind of guy that does revenge, but he still remembered what happened in the Storm's End, and it seemed like he wouldn't forget that. Like, when he was under siege there, right?
Yeah, he was.
That's true. He might, I mean...
There is no love lost, for sure. But I don't think that would play out to be an important thing.
Yeah. Renly could be the bridge there. I mean, if Renly is the bridge and he marries Margaery, like, first of all, he's a good match in general, but if he's likely to become king, just have to wait a little longer.
And Stannis is pragmatic enough to know that he can't simply live on without the Reach. You can't live without Dorne, no problem. But without the Reach in winter, bad. Yeah.
But would Stannis have permitted Renly to marry? First of all, would the Tyrells want to marry Margaery to Renly if Renly wasn't the king? And second of all, would Stannis permit an alliance between his younger brother and the most powerful family in his region's, you know, one of his region's sort of natural enemies? I don't know.
Yeah, because Stannis is the guy who thinks in terms of duty and stuff, so there is no reason for Renly to use this power against him, so why not? I'd say can go either way, but I have a gut feeling that he would have allowed it.
Yeah, yeah. The problem is R'hllor didn't will it, right, because of the visions.
Right.
So once that happened...
Well, I mean, that's... Yeah. Well, that's what I'm most concerned about in this theoretical is, Melisandre's influence, because I assume that even if the war were to end quicker in the Riverlands, Melisandre's mere presence in King's Landing would drive many of the same radicalizing forces that created the sort of more fundamentalist faith that winds up being a big deal in Feast and Dance. And you'd have someone who has no tolerance for that, as opposed to Cersei, who thought she could play them and work them. And then, you know, Melisandre, we've seen, is just wrong about who Azor Ahai is and the idea that Bloodraven and Bran are evil. That would be kind of a worrying... You know, she has more of an idea of what the real threat is than most, but she's misdiagnosed how to treat it, if you will. And I think that misdiagnosis could be perhaps just as dangerous in its way as, just having no idea at all. On the other hand, maybe she'd shore up the Night's Watch. Maybe she'd, but then that might not be a good thing either, because let's say she shores up the Night's Watch, then they have enough people to just, like, completely shut down Mance Rayner and completely scatter the wildlings. And so then you have a wild full of wildlings who become whites, and instead of being let through.
But then you'd have a unified realm against them, which would be better than what it is right now. But I think you were right that Melisandre probably wouldn't have as much influence if Stannis didn't need her to get the throne.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. I can't imagine Stannis becoming this religious guy when he doesn't really need her. He's a skeptical until he loses the Battle of King's Landing.
Yeah. Well, that's true. I mean, you know, Stannis, not show Stannis so much, but book Stannis is doing these things not because he particularly wants to, but because he's obligated to. That's the law. And he utilizes Melisandre, you know, because that's the only way he feels like he can enforce this law. And then eventually he becomes a little bit more of a believer, although not like a true believer.
So even in bed, he was just like, this is for the law. I'm doing my duty. Is that what he was doing? Or was there something else?
I mean, I mean, I'm sure, you know, she's hot and he's a man. And apparently, it was not enjoyable for him.
There are theories that apparently he was like unconscious or like some sort of tantric state or something. Didn't know what was going on.
Yeah, no, I don't. That sounds like Stannis Stan saying that, because Stannis would never, you know, get over yourselves. But sorry, Stannis is the Fury if you're listening. I don't know if that's a position you ascribe to, but you know, I just know I'm sure he was quite willingly went to Melisandre's bed and vice versa.
Yeah, definitely not for the sex, I guess, but for the power, for the tool. I mean, his cause is lost if he doesn't kill Renly, and she offers him away. And for the duty he has for the realm, he has to govern. He has to fuck her. A hard fate. No one would wish to be in his position.
Yeah, poor guy.
Hard to
I don't know. Well, I guess that exhausts the Stannis Renly alliance. Stefan, do you have a favorite what if?
Yeah, more or less. Upon a reread of A Game of Thrones, that's one question that I pondered for some time. Because when you remember after Eddard Stark was dead, or no, after he was captured, Sansa was captured, Arya had escaped, and then the Lannisters hold the first court after the capture of Ned. And what happens there is described in a Sansa POE, and they send all these ravens out, summoning everyone to court. Renly, Robb, Stannis, the Tyrells, all of them. And my question was, none of them turns up, obviously, but what if someone had turned up? What if this crazy-ass plan would have worked? You know, a total Lannister victory, basically, because everyone except Robb, if you will, really comes and pays homage. That's how they wanted it to be, you know.
Hmm. Well, I assume that would be that, right?
Yeah, I mean, you can make a point for Lysa Arryn, for example, because that's in the hands of Littlefinger. If he tells her to come, she will come.
Right.
So, it always bugged me. Did the Lannisters really think that one of them would turn up? Or did they just do it for show?
That seems like a pro forma thing that you do to give someone a chance before you... I mean, Ned says that he wants Tywin and Gregor Clegane to come, right? Mm. And answer to the charges.
Yeah, you're right.
So that just seems like, well, that's the thing that you do. And so then when you don't, you have license to kill them. So I'm sure they didn't expect a lot of that to happen. But if it did... Is the question whether the Lannisters would, when they got there, like pull a Mad King and execute them?
I don't know.
I don't think they would. I don't think that because it wouldn't be a situation like what happened, you know, on the steps at the Great Sept of Baelor, because, you know, you'd be, these are the most powerful lords. They wouldn't have been in prison. You know, they're not in like manacles, dragged out by like a jailer. It's just a different atmosphere. It would be, and then they'd be surrounded by their retainers and their guards and all that kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm sure they'd all come with like a big, huge, not big, huge, but like forces sufficient to really cause a problem.
Yeah.
If there was some kind of double cross, it's not just like Ned being dragged out of a black cell and tossed up there by himself. So I think it would go fine. My question then would become, who would work to undermine this?
How do you mean?
Well, let's say it all goes according to plan and everyone surrenders and Joffrey, good King Joffrey, rules unopposed and everyone keeps the king's peace. You know, Robb doesn't go to war. The Tyrells don't go to war. The brothers Baratheon don't go to war. I don't know, Balon Greyjoy even maybe doesn't go to war. I guess he definitely wouldn't, because he just was kind of taking advantage of the chaos.
Yeah.
Who out there would try and break that peace? But besides Littlefinger, anybody else?
Yeah, Littlefinger wouldn't really break the peace. He needs someone to do it for him. So,
well, I mean, that's what I mean.
I mean, he would work on the king and just make him more like make Joffrey into another mad king, probably. But I mean, Varys.
No, I don't really think. I don't really think that it needs that. I think the best route to go, which also would be taken, is to fuel Joffrey's paranoia about a secret Stark plot. I mean, yes, of course, they just did the oath thing, but do you really believe them? They are gathering armies. Just now we heard Rob was visiting the Eyrie. What has he done there? You know, stuff like that. You can't really be safe with these oaths.
Yeah, I assume they'd work the same fissures that in the real timeline actually split. You know, they'd attempt to convince Joffrey and Cersei that his uncles were conspiring against him, that Rob and Catelyn and, you know, the Tullys were angry, that, you know, and so on. And I guess it'd probably be, on Varys' part, a renewed emphasis on securing some kind of alliance with Dorne, would you think? Between Aegon and Dorne?
The problem with Aegon and all in Dorne is that Doran Martell is too cautious to act on his own. So he definitely needs allies. So in our scenario, who could these allies be? It's not Stark.
Yeah, I think.
Well, the allies would be Aegon and the Golden Company.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Varys didn't want things like he was saying things were going too quickly with the wealth on the line. He wanted things to be stalled a little bit. So this actually works toward Varys's thing. And if you read Alex's article from Tower of the Hand and Flight of Sorrows, he argues that maybe the Dothraki would have been just launched onto the kingdoms as a distraction, and then Aegon could move on to mop things up.
Yeah, that was always my theory, that, you know, what did they have to lose? At worst, a couple of Targaryen heirs that they hadn't put their resources into. You know, despite the fact that, you know, it's worth pointing out that Illyrio had access to Daenerys and Viserys for years and years and years, and they still lived like beggars. And she was still sold into sexual slavery to the Dothraki horde, while Aegon was trained by, like, the best people that money could buy and groomed to be the ruler. Which, again, you know, that to me says that Aegon is a fake, because, you know, the only reason you do that is if you assume Viserys, who is the rightful heir, is not going to pan out and you don't care. And Yeah, I don't know. I don't even. We're kind of getting off, or I'm kind of getting off on the sidetrack with all that stuff. I've always wondered, though, why Varys does sort of prod Ned along on the path that points to the Lannisters for Jon Arryn's death, and even though he knows that's not the case.
Have you read Stephen Atwell's essays on that topic?
I have, but I don't remember what he. What was the argument?
The specific argument to your specific question also eludes me at the moment, but his general line of thinking was, and what really burned into my mind, is that the whole timing of this conspiracy/crime investigation plot in King's Landing is of the utmost importance. It is hours or days in the most instances where everything is decided. So Varys wants things to go along in a specific direction, movement, but not as far as they are. You know, he gives Eddard hints, but never really enough. Never really enough to act and do stuff. It is Littlefinger who really gives the most important hints, especially the brothel. Varys would never have given that up. So he needs the latent conflict, but not the resolution. And the resolution is brought by Littlefinger.
And that's true. And also, Varys, I have no reason to doubt that Varys legitimately wanted Ned to take the Black and go to the Wall and live out his days there, because that would avoid war, but also eliminate a player that he would not ultimately be able to persuade to go along when Aegon showed up. You know, there'd be no Lord Eddard Stark, you know, Warden of the North anymore. He's just, you know, Lord Stark, commander of Grey, you know, Eastwatch by the sea or whatever, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it is definitely in his interest to get rid of Eddard, but not that fast.
Not the way that he did, right. So, Yeah, so let's say Varys has to weaken a united kingdom under King Joffrey, but not as fast as Littlefinger wants to weaken it.
Yep. It is. It comes all down to this juggler metaphor from Illyrio and Varys in the dungeons, because this make haste and a juggler can't keep the balls in the air. All these metaphors, they're really down to the point. He is.
Does Euron Greyjoy still, you know, have his brother killed and declare himself king?
Yeah, because he is not dependent.
He's crazy.
Yeah, right. And his plan is dependent on a magic MacGuffin and not on the political situation of the realm.
Yeah.
The horn always works, whether Starks and Lannisters are at war or not.
Yeah.
Or it doesn't work, don't know yet.
What do you think would happen if Ned was sent to the Wall?
Well, see, I got to thinking about that when I was rewatching the show with my mom, because, and I wrote a post about this, right at the time that, you know, Varys says to Ned, if you confess your treason, quote unquote, they will accept your confession and allow you to live out your days at the Wall. And just before that, you've seen, you know, zombies attack the Lord Commander, and you obviously know that there's some very strange supernatural forces going on above the Wall that no one else is paying attention to. So the narrative weight at that point, it makes sense for it to come down so that Ned gets sent to the Wall, and Ned is exactly the man the Wall needs at that point, you know, and you're, because you know he's the main character, and because you sense that what's going on above the Wall is the most important storyline, you then come to believe, if you don't know what's coming, that that's what's going to happen, and that's how the story will continue. This Ned will go up there, and there'll be a reunion with Jon, and he'll try and find his brother, and all these kinds of things, and of course it doesn't work out that way. But Ned would be, I think that would be really, in a lot of ways, I wonder if that's even superior to Ned living and successfully defeating the Lannisters. Mm. Because, you know, let's say Ned gets sent to the Wall. Presumably that will placate, I think that would placate Rob.
I mean, Ned doesn't have the legal authority anymore, but if he tells Rob, hey, like, just cut it out, like, he'll listen.
Yes.
So.
Which he would do to save his daughters and to avoid. Yeah. So, instead of the chaos that you have up north, you have an extremely capable leader at the Wall in the person of Eddard Stark, plus Jon, plus the old bear. You have a fully manned north with all its military might still up there. You don't have Roose and Ramsay Bolton and various Freys running around being fucking horrible. It's a very, very, you don't have Greyjoys up there. And so the others would have a much harder time if Ned blows it and gets arrested and gets betrayed and all his people get killed and all that happens in the exact same way, except Joffrey accepts his confession instead of cutting his head off. Yeah. That's possibly the ideal outcome.
Yeah, but I don't think it matters really that much, because if Ned is sent to the Wall, he will be, in the absence of his brother, he will be a natural second in command. Yeah. I think we can agree on that. So the most likely outcome is that the old bear still decides to do the great ranging. Instead of him, Ned Stark will command it, and he will die with the whole watch. And Jon will still be on the mission with Corin Halfhand and survive the whole shit. Come back to Castle Black, and the old bear is still alive, where he is most like to die, because face it, he's an old man and he's not exactly capable, and Jon becomes Lord Commander, so I don't think that would change that much.
But the thing is, though, the editor is like two things. He's kind of like a celebrity, which brings a spotlight to the Wall, but like second, like if he goes up there and he's like told by Jon and the old bear that there's something going on here, they might actually be able to get some more people up there, even though he doesn't have the legal authority to do so. You see what the North is willing to do for Ned. Like, it might put
the
focus
of
the North up there, right?
If Ned reached out to all the Northern Lords and was like, people, there's fucking zombies, there's goddamn others, like, you have to send people right away, they'd be like, they wouldn't be like, oh, Ned, no. You know, they love him, they're loyal to him, and also, as Northerners, they're more apt to believe in these things.
Yes.
Because it's much more part of their culture than it is in the South or the West. So, yeah,
Yeah, but now comes my big butt, because you have one problem with
Let's talk about your big butt, Stefan. Let's talk about your
my big butt. Yeah, It's a very sexy butt I have here. So let's talk about it. As my problem is that Ned Stark could have done this, and probably it would have all the beneficial effects you said, but it is Ned Stark we're talking about. So before he does it, he wants to have proof. So he still goes out there to do this fucking expedition. He will fail. So I still think it doesn't change that much, except that I was able to show my butt around.
Yeah. Well, but he'd have the proof. He'd have his son and, or excuse me, his nephew, and the old bear telling him what happened, right?
Yeah.
Plus, presumably, we don't know. Well, this is not presumably. There's some question as to whether Ned is preserving John's life and John's secret simply out of loyalty to his sister because the kid's his nephew, or if he's doing it because his sister has successfully convinced him that John is one of the three heads of the dragon. Like, we don't know whether Ned is privy to that prophecy, if he believes in it, if he thinks...
Don't think so.
You know. Mm. Well, I've always kind of wondered if that's one of the reasons he allows John to go to the wall. Because he thinks John has a part to play there. No. I mean, there's all sorts of reasons. This is to get him away from Rob. This is to get him away from Catelyn. There's because he stands a better chance of sort of rising in the wall's equivalent of society as a bastard. There's because, you know, there's a known Targaryen who had been in the line of succession up there, and Robert still hasn't gone after him because that's just how taboo it is to try and kill people who belong to the Night's Watch. But I have wondered if that's a part of it.
No, I don't think so. It is not Ned to believe in such prophecies.
Yeah, and he doesn't need to have taken care of John. Just the familial duty is enough. In fact, if he knew that it was like for a greater purpose for the whole world, it wouldn't be bearing down on him as much as if it's just for the promise for love that he's doing it for.
I don't understand what you mean.
Like, I mean, like, he's doing it for his sister's love, but he's not like, if he already also knew in his head that, like, I'm doing this for, like, the weight of the kingdom, it would be different. I think he'd think about it differently than the way he thinks about it. Like,
it would be in his thoughts.
But even in your worst butt scenario, like, that with Eddard dying, I mean, like, at least the Northerners would be back up north. There'd be more contact between Rob and John, maybe, or, it's like, there'd be more chance of getting help at the wall. Plus, if Eddard dies beyond the wall, they'd probably be like, what's going on? Like, there'll be more, like, of a spotlight.
Yeah, there will be more of a fuss, I grant you that. But in the short term, there wouldn't be much to it.
But do you think Stannis would still end up going up north? Like, the same thing would happen in the south, you think? Or what would happen? Like,
I mean, Stannis goes north because...
He's lost. And
he lost the war. Yeah. That's the only reason.
Yeah.
And, yeah, well, so he wouldn't go north, but if he gets the call to come there, he would follow it, if that's what you mean. You know, if the Night's Watch calls on him, either as king or as Lord Stannis, simply, if he is needed and if it's his duty, then he will follow it. Imagine Robert or King Joffrey doing that.
Yeah, and Stannis, well... I don't know. Stannis at least respects Eddard Stark as a serious man.
Yes.
You know, doesn't
would,
like
he would
him.
Believe him.
Yes, that's right. That's right. He would believe him.
After he has checked sanity, but then...
Right. Well, I mean, that's it. I've made up my mind. What I want to have happened is for Ned's plot to lose, but then for him to get sent to the wall, because I think it would work out better all the way around. I'm much more I'm thinking much more positively than you, Stefan.
Okay.
And wouldn't it be better for Sansa as well? Like, technically, they probably would have sent her back eventually. Like, after, like, they might wait for a bit, see that he doesn't do anything, and then send Sansa back.
Yeah, Rob bends the knee, and sends Jaime back. They return. No, I don't know. They might... I don't know. Maybe they would still insist on marrying him to Sansa. Or maybe they would break that because, like, well, we hate each other.
I don't think, like, Tywin would keep that going. Tywin's more pragmatic than that. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, it has its ups and downs, but I guess the Margaery match is more important because you need a working alliance and not a hostage alliance as king.
Well, and if Ned isn't dead, it takes a little bit longer for Sansa to see how evil Joffrey is. Like, it'll still come out eventually, but it won't be as obvious. Like, if he actually kept his word and sent him to the wall.
Yeah.
Hmm.
But she will figure it out sooner or later.
Well, why don't you ask you have your listeners weigh in and let us know if this was an ideal situation.
Listeners, don't let me down. I'm counting on you.
Or you go for my butt.
You know why they're listening to this, right?
That's right, because we they say you have a face for radio. Well, Stefan has a butt for radio.
So it is.
I don't know. I mean, have we exhausted our topics for now? Or?
Yeah.
I guess we could go on 4 hours, but at some point that's we true. Have to wrap it up. So now it's as good as any, and we continue it some other time.
Yeah, this could be a series fairly easily, I think. So
yeah, let's
think about it next time. Well, Amin, thank you so much for stopping by electronically and participating in this with us, our sort of grand comeback. It's always awesome to have you. And you know that the big mothership of Song of Ice and Fire podcast has no bigger fans than the two of us. So thank you very much.
Thank you. That warm and fuzzy feeling again.
Yeah, well, that's what I aim for, Stefan. I aim for that warm and fuzzy feeling from you.
Oh, yes.
Well, thank you, everybody. Yes, everyone, thank you very much for listening. Glad to be back, and we hope to talk to you again soon.